Blog Talk Radio.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. That which touches me most is that I had a chance to work with people, passing on to others that which was passed on to me. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. To me, young people come first.
They come first.
They have the courage where we fail. And if I can but shed some light as they carry us through the gate.
This is the Gist of Freedom. I am Leslie Gist, your host, and we have a special show tonight. We have a professor of constitutional law. Are you on the line, Ms. Brown?
Yes, I am.
Okay, could you please introduce yourself to the audience?
My name is Gloria Brown Marshall, and I'm so pleased to be here. Thank you for everyone who's listening. I teach at John Jay College. I teach constitutional law, race in the law, gender and justice, as well as evidence, and I'm the founder and director of the nonprofit organization, the Law and Policy Group. We produce the report on the status of black women and girls.
Wonderful. Could you explain to the audience why we are talking tonight, why we have this special show tonight, and why you're here?
Well, I was asked to be on the show to talk about Trayvon Martin and the recent events that have taken place in this very spectacular case, and I mean spectacular in the ups and downs that we've all gone on this roller coaster ride as a nation, and it's going to continue, but we've had some really extremely remarkable events take place today, and that is, of course, the charging of George Zimmerman.
Wonderful. Now, could you just update us and just go through the case from the beginning to the, as the facts that you know?
Well, I don't know every fact, but I will tell you those I am aware of. On the night of February 26th of this year, Trayvon Martin, a 17-year-old, who was visiting his father and his father's girlfriend in a community in Sanford, Florida, a gated community that's been said many times, one without a lot of crime, was walking home from a 7-Eleven after purchasing some Skittles, a packet of Skittles, and an iced tea. He was walking along the street. It began to rain, and he put his hoodie on his head that he, you know, of course, keep his head warm. And George Zimmerman, 28, who is of mixed heritage, his father's white, his mother's Latino, was the volunteer neighborhood watch guard, and he notices Trayvon. He calls 911 to say that there's a suspicious person in the neighborhood, begins to follow him. He tells the 911 dispatcher he's going to follow. Dispatcher says, do not follow. And he follows him anyway. He's carrying a gun, a concealed weapon for which he has a permit. And he confronts in some way Trayvon because he was following behind him. Trayvon is talking to his girlfriend on the phone, saying someone is following me. And from that point on, we have the dispute. George Zimmerman says Trayvon confronts him, and others have said that George Zimmerman, the 28-year-old heavyset man, is actually the one who confronted the teenager, who was slight built. And at the end of the night, Trayvon Martin has been shot once by George Zimmerman. In Sanford, Florida, and in many places, there are laws that allow for a person to shoot in self-defense and not be charged with a crime. George Zimmerman was taken to the Sanford Police Department. We find out later from a tape that even though George Zimmerman said he was attacked by Trayvon and his nose was broken and his head was beaten against the ground, we find that there were no marks that were obvious in the videotape from the police department. And from that point on, there have been any number of marches, protests, petitions from around the country and around the world. We've also had United Nations speak to this, as well as President Barack Obama, all of them asking for justice. And then today, finally, after February 26th with the shooting, we have a special prosecutor, Angela Corey, who was asked to take over the case, and she has charged George Zimmerman with second-degree murder.
Wow. There's a lot to ask. Let's start off by asking about the standing your ground law that they're trying to apply to George Zimmerman. Can you hear me?
Yes. Well, the stand your ground law is actually found in over 20 states, and there are other states looking at the stand your ground law. We have in this country a common law, or a law that's left over from this sense of your home is your castle that comes because we've adopted a lot from English law. One of the American laws we have, of course, is that if someone enters your home, then you have a right to defend yourself within your home. We also have an affirmative defense in any type of criminal action that if you're attacked, you have a right to defend yourself. The Stand Your Ground law combines the two of those, where it used to be that if you're on the outside of your home and someone walks up to you, the obligation is for you to avoid the fight and walk away. But you're allowed to defend yourself if someone enters your home. Understand your ground law, you don't have to walk away if someone steps up to you outside of your home. You get the same rights you would have if you were in your home. You have the right to stand your ground. You don't have to walk away. The same way you wouldn't have to walk away from your own home if someone enters your home, you don't have to run out the back. They're saying if you're on the street and someone walks up to you and they intend to hurt you, you can defend yourself. You don't have to walk away. And so these stand your ground laws, as I said, found in more than 20 states around the country, are laws that allow the person, if they stand their ground with a weapon, shoot the other person, and that person dies, as long as they claim self-defense, they are not to be arrested. They are not to go through the criminal system at all. In this particular case with Trayvon Martin, there are no key eyewitnesses. As we know, there are people who might have heard certain things, like there's a scream for help, and that scream for help could be heard from the person who called to say that there's a struggle taking place in the dark. Remember, it's dark and it's raining. And so the person who's hearing this in their home calls 911. You can hear over the telephone the cries for help. George Zimmerman said that was him crying for help. Now we're going to have, and I think the special prosecutor, Angela Corey, is going to bring in a voice recognition specialist to find out if that was indeed George Zimmerman. Because if it was Trayvon Martin calling for help, then it was not self-defense, because the other person was the one being wounded.
The standing your ground, who originated the bill? Who asked, you know, which legislator is responsible for passing this bill?
Well, since I'm not from Florida, I'm not sure who initiated it. I was told, and I am familiar with the fact that there are states initiating these types of bills because of bullying. And, you know, a person who's being bullied is someone who's, you know, may, you know, walk away from the bully because of carjacking, and people who are having their cars carjacked, You know, should they walk away? Should they leave their car and let somebody take it? Or can they fight for their possessions? These things are issues that were, of course, very important to communities. And so the legislature decided that instead of telling people to walk away from bullies, walk away from carjackers, walk away from people who intend to harm them, that you can carry a gun and you can defend yourself against someone who means you harm. So that is what I've been told was the impetus for these Stand Your Ground laws, but they've gotten out of control. Because, as I said, over 20 states, without any real parameters around what conditions lead up to self-defense, what is the meaning of self-defense, how far is somebody allowed to go and then claim self-defense, and that's what this case is bringing to light.
Wonderful. Now, you mentioned there were some marches, and even the president made a comment. Could you just update us and give us some of the most profound and memorable comments that you heard, most outrageous and unified comments?
Well, I know that in New York City, in Union Square, there were protests early on. And I teach at John Jay College. As I pointed out, I teach racial law and constitutional law. And I actually asked my students, you know, whether or not they were going to participate. And my college had a program around Trayvon Martin. So these programs were going, you know, around the country. As a matter of fact, we have a teacher in Pontiac, Michigan, who was fired, African-American female teacher, fired because she put on a program with her high school students, I believe. And so she's trying to get her job back because she said, well, you know, I wasn't doing anything wrong. I was helping them to understand. We have a lot of young black males who are feel very vulnerable to attack. Because this whole issue is if a young person, while it's raining, puts a hood on their head, does that make them into a criminal? And so you have three instances. The Union Square instance was one of the larger ones in the very beginning. And it wasn't just young black males who were at Union Square Park in New York City. There were white, older people, a whole mix, and they were carrying signs, and the signs read, I am Trayvon Martin. So this whole sense of solidarity, and the parents of Trayvon Martin actually attended those marches, and the parents said they wanted justice. Trayvon Martin's mother, Sabrina Fulton, as well as his father, Tracy Martin, were there in Union Square Park. That evening, Reverend Al Sharpton was there to speak about all of us at any time under this law could be shot dead just for looking like we're threatening to somebody. Who knows what a threat is in somebody else's mind for them to actually pull a gun and shoot and say it was self-defense. We also had, of course, Geraldo Rivera. You're talking about someone doing something completely ridiculous and shameful, who on his show advised black parents to tell their teenagers not to wear hoodies, because wearing a hoodie was a gangsta look, G-A-N-S-T-A, gangsta look. And that way you're asking for trouble, and you need to not wear it. And it just so happened that I was being interviewed for somebody the day that by a radio station by that day, and I said it was shameful. And I said, shame on you, Geraldo Rivera, and I say it now, because what is it? You can't buy Skittles, you can't, you know, wear a hoodie. There's a whole list of things, driving while black, walking while black, being black, that you can't do because it puts fear into white people or non-blacks, and they're allowed to kill us because they sense fear. Not that we're doing anything threatening, but their very existence causes them to feel insecure. And then we also had in Congress, we had Representative Scott, Representative Bobby Rush from Illinois, actually decided to take the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives. And while he was taking the floor, he put on a hoodie, put it over his head, and put on glasses, and he quoted from the Bible, you know, and he was dismissed from the floor of the House of Representatives because they have a rule that no one is allowed to wear a hat, and they consider the hoodie a hat. And so they actually turned off the microphone and had the sergeant of arms dismiss him because he was not in the correct or proper decorum for the House floor. of Congress. So these are three examples I would give of protests that have taken place. But there have been protests all over the country.
Right. Now, today they had a press conference. Could you tell us about the press conference, what you observed?
Well,
remarkable comments that they made.
Well, there were a number. I think that was very interesting on the part of the parents who have said that they do not want this to turn into a racial issue. But it is already a racial issue, and I can understand their point. They lost a son. They don't want to be in the middle of a race war, and they don't want race riots. They don't want anything racial to take place. But to me, this is a racial incident. And especially given the fact that it could be deemed a hate crime, I understand the parents' position. But one thing that Trayvon Martin's mother said, she said that, you know, her heart is not black, her heart is not white, her heart is red. And her heart is broken. She lost her son. And, you know, in losing her son, she's trying to get justice. She wants him arrested. It was also very interesting, and it's very important, what Tracy Martin, Trayvon's father, said. And he was like, yes, this is an arrest, but we can't stop here. And I think that, more than anything else, motivates me to talk with you and your listeners, because so many times we have this war of attrition going on. And when I say a war of attrition, it means we have to fight for every single inch of progress we make as a people, every inch. And it wears us down for every aspect of justice. For this one case, we had to have all these protests taking place for this one simple case just to get an arrest. But we also have to go through the whole court system. Who's going to be the judge? Who are the jurors? Are they going to ask for a transfer of venue to change it to another place? I'm sure they are. I mean, all these things have to take place before you get real justice. We can't leave this at the arrest and think that we should be satisfied.
That's true. You mentioned a hate crime. I thought of the Shepard Byrd case that Obama signed to law. Could you give us the background, and if that's applicable in this case?
Well, the Shepard case and Byrd case, the Shepard case was one involving a young gay male who was led out into the cold, I believe it was Montana or South Dakota, and he was led out into the cold because he was gay, tied to a fence and left to die there in the freezing cold. And, of course, Mr. Byrd was in Texas, who was, and that was a gay white male, but he was, this would happen to him because of his sexual orientation. Mr. Byrd, a black male in Texas, was minding his own business, and two white males who wanted to harm someone black just because they were black decided to beat him up, tie him to the back of a truck, and drag him behind the truck until he was decapitated. And at that point, you know, they dragged his dead body behind the truck and then threw it off to the side of the road. These two white males, because of this hate crime, both of those being hate crimes, were, you know, examples of a true hate crime, both of them. And so that's why legislation was signed to speak to these types of hate crimes. And those are the examples of what a hate crime is. Sometimes a hate crime cannot be as clear-cut, and we don't know, and that's why there has to be first the crime, and then the next level of the crime is considered the examination of whether or not it's a hate crime. For example, in Mississippi last year, a white teenager, Daryl Dedman, who lived in a suburb of Mississippi, he and friends left a birthday party with the intent of having fun, and their idea of fun is to find a homeless or a drunk black person and beat that person senseless. That's their idea of fun in a black neighborhood. So they leave their white enclave, drive their pickup trucks into an all-black neighborhood, look for a vulnerable black person, and then beat that person up. And so they come across Mr. Anderson, who's in the parking lot. He's not drunk. He's not homeless. He's alone in the parking lot in the early morning, and they proceed to beat him up. While he's walking down the street, beaten now, senseless, you know, wandering back and forth, almost unconscious, but he hasn't fallen to the ground yet. He's looking for help. then Daryl Deadman, an 18-year-old, gets in his pickup truck and runs him down, backs up over his body and runs over him again, all because he's black. And
wow.
It just so happens that there's a video camera taking videotape of this whole incident, and that's why that's the only way this person was found. This would have been just a dead body on the street. And so they find Daryl Deadman. They try him not just for murder, but also for a hate crime, which elevates the sentence in the case. It's harder to prove, but once it is proven, then that person receives a higher sentence. And so Daryl Deadman, at 19 years old, pleaded guilty and received two concurrent sentences, life sentences. And he was sentenced during the same time this whole debate was going on about the arrest of George Zimmerman.
That's an awful story and testimony for our country at a time when we have a black president in the White House. Could you just tell the audience what President Obama said about the Trayvon case?
Well, as we all know, the president was asked about this case, and he said if he had a son, he would look like Trayvon. And there are conservatives who actually said, well, he's going to rue the day, like regret the day he ever said this. Because they want him to be president, but they don't want him to ever talk about anything racial. They don't ever want him to talk about anything black. And just when he gave his talk on race, and I'm very proud to admit that my book, Race, Law, and American Society, 1607, the Present, was one of the resources he used in giving that talk on race.
Wow. Congratulations. I have to say congratulations.
Thank you. That's actually, this is the first time I've actually mentioned it. I should mention it more often, huh? But, yeah, so he rarely speaks directly about the issue of race. But I think he has learned, and is, because he comes from a biracial family, that race can be an intellectual experience for some, but for black people it's a real experience. It's a life experience, and it's a lifelong experience. And it comes out in so many different ways. And that's why I said it's a war of attrition. And one thing that we have to do, and it's so difficult, but we have to remember the joy in life, because there are people who want us to not ever experience any joy. They want us not to experience happiness, opportunity, and they want our lives to always be miserable and sad. And so many people are used to bad things happening to black people that we don't get any real sympathy when things happen. If a white person is injured, is that sympathy? There's sympathy for that. But a black person has to die in horrendous ways for that same level of sympathy to take place, because we become numb, even ourselves, you know, let alone other people. We become numb to the harshness of the reality of mistreatment that takes place when it comes to people of color. So we need to not lose sight of our joy despite all the misery people want our lives to be. We know ourselves that we have bursts of happiness. We have bursts of joy. We have bursts of laughter. And we need to cling to that joy. We need to cling to that laughter. We don't need to party all the time, but we do need to know that people want our lives to be more miserable than they are, and we're not going to give them that.
Great.
And
before we move on to the historical segment and talk about the Constitution and Dred Scott, let's let the audience know who you are again and how they can reach you and how they can purchase your book.
Well, once again, I'm Professor Gloria Brown Marshall at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City, and that's part of the City University of New York. And I teach constitutional law, race and the law, evidence, as well as gender and justice. I think it's very important for us to understand the inequalities based on gender, as well as the inequalities based on being a person of color. My area of research is constitutional and international law as protections for vulnerable groups like women, children, and people of color. And I have several books, one of them being Race, Law, and American Society, 1607 to Present. And Race, Law, and American Society, 1607 to Present, looks at the struggle from the 1600s to the present, and it connects the dots. If we ever wonder why things are the way they are today, when we don't have these segregationist laws on the books, we have to realize that this country has lived with segregation much longer, much, much longer than it's lived with us being free. So the mindset is still under that mindset of segregation, and we have vestiges or remnants of that mindset we're living with today. And so my book has chapters on education and voting rights, and the longer chapter is criminal justice, but it also looks at the military, it looks at property ownership and civil liberties like marriage and protest, as well as internationalism. And it's the only book to do this. Race Law in American Society, 1607 to Present, is the only book to have all these different areas in one book. Most books have something on criminal justice, and that's it. Or it's on education and race, and that's it. My book has all of these different areas and cases from the 1600s up until, you know, the 1990s, 2000s, of course, to present. And that's Race Law in American Society. And I also have books on the Constitution. And I'm the assigned special correspondent to cover the U.S. Supreme Court and look at these constitutional law cases before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Which one are you covering right now?
Well, right now there are a number of them. I'm looking at these cases involving, for example, one of the upcoming arguments will be on the Arizona law, on whether or not Arizona can have these immigration laws where they have police departments actually asking people for their immigration documents, and if they don't show that documentation, being able to arrest people and then detain them and give them over to the immigration service for deportation. And so that's one of the major cases being argued before the U.S. Supreme Court coming up, I believe, on April 25th. I was also covering the health care arguments, and that was a three-day oral argument scheduled last week or so, in which we had these issues regarding whether or not the Affordable Care Act was constitutional. Can we actually mandate people to have health care? So that was another issue before the Supreme Court. And it's amazing the variety of issues before the court. I was there for an oral argument on whether or not it's a violation of cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment to have 14 people who have committed crimes, homicides, when they were 14 years old, whether or not it's cruel and unusual punishment to try and convict them as adults, put them in adult prisons, and give them life without possibility of parole. So that was another case argued before the U.S. Supreme Court that I was covering.
Now, I want to jump on the one about the immigration in Arizona, because that's close to where we are right now. When we go back to the Constitution in 1792 and 1793 about the Fugitive Slave Law, could you explain how these dots are connected to what's going on today, starting with the right to have a warrant to be arrested?
Well, I'm trying to. Which parts are you? That's a big area.
Okay, I was just talking about what I was talking about was the Fugitive Slave Law 1850.
Mm-hmm.
How it was changed from the original Fugitive Slave Law of 1792, where the bounty hunters had to get a warrant in order to arrest someone they deemed to be a fugitive.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1850, they changed the law. And you know, and then I wanted to just see, you know, this is just a question. I'm not an expert. But I wanted to know if there was a connection between that and, you know, the Dred Scott case and now what you're going through with in Arizona.
Well, all of that could be a book.
Okay.
But one thing that I look at, first and foremost, you have these issues of federalism. And federalism is the balance of power between the states and the federal government. So under the Constitution, when the Constitution was drafted in 1787 and then ratified in 1789, there were framers in that room in 1787 who argued that we need a central government as opposed to having each state be able to do individually what it wanted to do, because the country was only going to be as strong as the weakest state, and that state would then undermine the viability of the whole country. But there were abolitionists in that room as well as slaveholders in that room in Philadelphia in 1787. So a lot that we see in the U.S. Constitution is a compromise from that time period. How much power would each state give up? Would they be willing to sign on to an agreement, which is what the Constitution is, an agreement, to have a strong central government? How much would the slaveholders have to give up? What were the abolitionists willing to do if they were not allowed to have their wish, which was to end slavery in 1787? So one of the things they came up with was to please the slaveholders, because they made their money not just off the slaves themselves, but off what the slaves produced in cotton, tobacco, and other products. So they have the fugitive slave provision within the U.S. Constitution. So Article 4 of the U.S. Constitution is a fugitive slave provision. That was the compromise they made first in 1787. Because the slaveholders said, well, you know, if we have this new country and you free the slaves, which is what Thomas Jefferson wanted to do initially, and Benjamin Franklin, it's like, well, if you free these slaves, then I'm broke. I have no money. I have no assets. I have no collateral. So, you know, all these people in the room in 1787 were wealthy and educated, so they said, okay, I'm not going to do that. We'll eventually end slavery. That was the agreement. So the other part was in the U.S. Constitution. Remember, the Fugitive Slave Clause is in Article 4. The other part, of course, was the three-fifths rule. How do we count the number of slaves in order to determine the number of U.S. representatives to Congress? So African Americans, free and enslaved, were counted as three-fifths of a person. The other part of it is, are we ever going to end slavery? Yes, we are. Well, here's the first part. In 1808, and this is in the U.S. Constitution in Article 1, Section 9, in 1808, we will end the importation and exportation of slaves. All of that is what was agreed on in the U.S. in that Constitutional Convention in 1787. But that wasn't enough to really please the slaveholders, because enslaved people were running away. That's when you start getting to those next Fugitive Slave Acts that came out. So by the time we get to 1850 and we've had enough of the enslaved Africans leaving, we have territories becoming states, and whether or not those territories are free territories or slave territories, you know, all of these issues are coming to pass. 1831, we had the Nat Turner Rebellion in Southampton, Virginia, which really cracked down on a lot of what enslaved people and black people generally who were free could do, because that put the fear in these white people that, oh, how many slave insurrections might we have? We had Denmark Vesey. We had all these things taking place. So by 1850, they said, not only will you be taken back if you go into a free state from a slave state, but our bounty holders, our bounty will not have to have, as you pointed out, a warrant. But in addition to that, anyone who participates in helping an enslaved person escape from slavery, because slavery is a law, escaping from slavery is a crime. Slavery is the law. Escaping is a crime. And so if you assist someone to escape, you are also a criminal, and you can be held, white, black, or otherwise, you can also be held under criminal indictment. So by the time we get to 1850, we see things have really gotten to a very high level of tension in the country around freedom and enslavement and who can actually access this country as it's growing during the Industrial Revolution. Who can actually get the benefits and the opportunities this country has to offer? And the other part of this is when we see the abolitionists like John Brown, who was white and led his rebellion in Virginia, when we see these people rising up and we see the other people who are the slaveholders digging in, the idea is slavery is on the way out. By 1861, We know that the Civil War begins. People say that it's not about slavery. It, to me, it's not completely about slavery. It's about power. It's about economics. It's about politics. But in the core of all of this, underlining in all of this, is slavery. So when slavery ends, the idea is who's going to do this work for free? We want Chinese. We want Europeans. We want all these immigrants. We bring them all in after slavery ends, and we have the same issues now we had then. And those issues are we bring all these people in when we have jobs. Then there was another depression of sorts. We have the end of Reconstruction, and we have these immigrants, and we turn around, and what do? The Chinese Exclusion Act we have in the 1800s. We say we no longer want these Irish. We don't want these other poor Europeans coming over here, taking the jobs from the whites who have already been here. They're undermining the how much we can pay. So this same issue that we're dealing with in Arizona, we've dealt with time and time again in this country. What kind of laws prevent people from going where they want to go? What controls we have on people of color? And what we do after we invite all these people to come here to do the work, when the economy bottoms out and these people are still here, what do we do with them? The other thing is the 14th Amendment, the first line of the 14th Amendment grants citizenship at birth. That 14th Amendment provision was created for the African who have been here since the 1600s and some say the 1500s, and yet they were not considered citizens of this country because of the Dred Scott case.
That's where we wanted to go next. Right, go ahead.
Yes. And so after the war ended, in order to undo what the U.S. Supreme Court had done in 1857 in the Dred Scott case and finding that Dred Scott wasn't a citizen, wasn't a person, and had no rights a white man need respect, they had to give the African rights because the U.S. Supreme Court creates the law of the land, just like Congress, just like the president. So they had to give the Africans rights under law. That's why the 13th Amendment abolished slavery except for punishment for a crime. The 14th Amendment provides for citizenship at birth as well as immunities and privileges as well as due process and equal protection under law. And then the 15th Amendment gives black men the right to vote. So those rights were given to Africans. They had those rights in certain areas, free Africans did in the country, but then, you know, under the Dred Scott decision written by Justice Taney, if they weren't rights, they were considered privileges, they could be taken away by whites at any time.
Could you explain what the case with Dred Scott, how that come about?
Well, Dred and Harriet Scott, and people forget about Harriet. Dred and Harriet Scott, and I have a book coming out soon, and that book is Black Women. From Salem witch trials to civil rights activists, black women from Salem witch trials to civil rights activists, a legal history. And so that will be coming out this year. And the reason why I raise it now is because in that book I speak about Harriet Scott as well. The case is Dred and Harriet Scott versus Sanford. She was part of that case as well. And Dred Scott and Harriet Scott followed Dr. Emerson, who was an Army surgeon, and transferred, as military people are, to different parts of the country, and he was transferred to a free territory. And Dred Scott and Harriet Scott went with him to this territory. They had two children, and then when Dr. Emerson was sent back to St. Louis, Dred and Harriet Scott arrived back in St. Louis. And I hesitate there because the question can become, did they voluntarily come back to St. Louis because they chose to out of their own free will, or did they feel obligated to come back? That's a very important question, because when they arrive back and Dr. Emerson dies, at that time women cannot own property in their own name. So his widow then has the Dred Scott, Harriet Scott, and the two children. Dred Scott asked to buy his freedom from the widow. She denies him. Her brother, now being the male, inherits power over Dred and Harriet Scott, and they say he might have had some type of mental illness because he begins to beat them. and the children. Dred Scott is like, oh, no, I'm not having this. He sues for his freedom, and he wins at trial. He
now, was this a free state? Was this state free at the time when he sued?
No, he's in St. Louis, Missouri. So he's in a slave state suing for his freedom. But here's the remarkable thing. St. Louis, Missouri has a treasure trove of cases brought by Africans who are enslaved seeking their freedom. There was something called a slave court, and they could actually go before this court with having traveled, because the law was if a slaveholder, now you got me excited, Leslie, you better stop it, okay? Because if the law was if a slaveholder knowingly took their slave into a free state, that enslaved person could become free. Because the idea is, if you know this is a free state, and you're taking somebody into a free state, then you should know that once they get there, they're free. If they find out they're free and they get away, they can remain free. So the question even before Dred Scott was, if someone is in a free state, do they become free? So when Dred Scott was taken by Dr. Emerson into a free state, it wasn't the first time that someone had been taken into a free state and then brought back into a slave state and sued for their freedom, and especially in St. Louis, because there were a number of cases in my book, Black Women, Salem Witch Trials, the Civil Rights Activists, and that book is from the 1600s up to the 1960s, the Civil Rights Activists. And so in my book, I talk about these different cases and a number of different cases in which black women had sued for their freedom during that time period. And so in looking at this, I'm saying, oh, my goodness, Dred Scott is doing what he saw other people do. But because of the tensions I mentioned before about people losing their property, where they had granted freedom to these previous people, this time around they didn't want to grant the freedom anymore.
Now, which law was the judge really referring to when he made that famous quote? And I can't remember it offhand. But was there a specific law that he was really, you know, talking about when he talked about the rights of a black man and a white man?
I don't know what you mean.
You know, what was the quote that the judge said that there was no law that a white man had to respect?
Oh, right? That a black man had no rights, a white man need respect.
Right. Was there one specific law that he was referring to or anything? Like,
no,
you know,
actually,
with the Trevon case, we know we're talking about stand your ground law. Was there something in the midst in that case?
Well, actually, Justice Taney, who wrote the opinion on behalf of the court, was referring to the framers, the very framers in 1787. And what he was saying was that those framers never intended for the Constitution to cover or protect or give rights to black people. And then if you have a chance to read the Dred Scott decision, it will curl your toes. Some of the horrific things that this justice wrote, I mean, just horrible. You know, how black people were meant from the beginning of time by God himself, you know, to work on behalf of white people. That was their only, you know, purpose in being alive, was to work for their superiors for their lifetime. And, you know, so anything that a white person might give them, you know, is a privilege. You have no right. And that's what he meant. It's like if a white person decides to allow you freedom to walk around, that's a privilege. You have no rights. A white man needs respect. You have merely privileges that can be taken away at any given time.
Do you think we had that feeling as black people, the same type of feeling that Dred Scott had when they would not arrest Zimmerman?
Well, I mean, there are a number of different ways to look at it. You can look at it from the standpoint of, there are tensions, there are racial tensions, and I write about these racial tensions because, as I told you, I write about these issues in my books, but I also have weekly columns, and I write for the Bay State Banner newspaper out of Boston. I write for the Black Star News, out of Brooklyn and a number of different other newspapers as a freelance journalist. And what I write about when it comes to some of these laws is that laws are, on their face, supposed to be equal now, but they can be used in different ways. If you have laws to protect people's rights, but you don't protect the rights of black people, then the message is that you don't value those people because they're not worthy of protection. That is a vestige from the time period when black people couldn't even access the court system. You were more afraid of the sheriff and the deputy than you were of other people, because it's like you'd rather not have the deputy. You never knew when the deputy or the sheriff was part of the Klan, you know,
right.
or someone who would do you more harm than good. So we couldn't even access the criminal justice system. Things are better than they were, I have to say.
Yes, of course they are.
Yeah, of course they're better than they were, but there are a lot of people who believe in a social racial hierarchy. And a social racial hierarchy means that there are certain white people with money who are supposed to be at the top, then you have white people with a middle bit of money, then you have white people with no money, then you have all these other people of color at the bottom. And
now, George Zimmerman, is it true that his father was a judge or is a retired judge?
I know nothing about that. I know his father's white and his mother's Latina. But going back to your point about how people could feel when it comes to the lack of protection under law, then it's sending a message you're not as valuable. It's sending a message that you have privileges, not rights. And that is the message from Dred Scott that you were alluding to before. That you have privileges. When we feel like giving you legal protection, we will. If we don't feel like giving it, then we won't. Those are privileges. A right means you have it no matter what, and that's what the rule of law is supposed to be about, that everyone is protected by law equally. But a privilege is something that takes place when anyone in a position of power deems to give it to you.
Now,
that's
when,
what Dred Scott was about.
Okay. Now, when, historically speaking, what case brought justice about to Dred Scott and to the rest of us that we're enjoying today?
Say it again.
Which case? We had a Dred Scott case was a landmark case. What was the next landmark case that undid the Dred Scott case and gave black people the rights and not privileges that Dred Scott was seeking?
Well, it wasn't a case. You know, what had to be put in place to undo what Dred Scott did was the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. And after that, unfortunately, there were a number of U.S. Supreme Court cases that undermined the rights that were set out in the 14th Amendment to the point where we got to 1896 and Plessy versus Ferguson, which, you know, of course, was a doctrine of separate but equal, that really undermined the rights of black people and attempted once again to stop our progress. And this is all about, from my perspective, how we fight against people who set obstacles in front of us to keep us from progressing. That's what it's about. I mean, it's kind of like this race in which you have, and a race not in the racial standpoint, but a race as in a contest. You have resources, and people don't want to share those resources. That's fine, because in the jungle, people don't share, people take. And I'm not saying that we're in the jungle, but this is Earth. This is not heaven. In heaven, there'll be enough for everybody. On Earth, there are scarce resources. And so you have people who believe that unless they take everything, and not only take it, but keep you from having yours, that they will never have enough. And so we're dealing with people who don't want black people to progress in ways, despite the fact that we've done everything, math, science, the arts, everything, athletics, we've achieved in every area, even with all of these obstacles on our backs. And yet there are people who will deem us unworthy because in their minds, they don't want us to be worthy, which is their mindset. But when you step over the line and you put obstacles in someone else's place, when you put legal obstacles, when you keep them from being protected by law, and in Trayvon Martin's case, when you actually take their lives and then prevents that person from being actually receiving justice, from being a part of the criminal justice system and receiving the justice they're supposed to receive, then to me, you not only have violations of the law, but you have human rights violations. So we had all that take place under Plessy versus Ferguson, horrific human rights violations. I mean, we had sterilization in this country. You know, we had lynchings in this country. We had all these things taking place. And then in 1954, Brown versus Board of Education spoke to the issue of segregation of the races, especially among primary school children in public schools. And that landmark case, Brown v. Board of Education, once again a compromise case, but it made a change in this country, which brought us into the Montgomery bus boycott, which followed the lynching of Emmett Till in 1955, into the civil rights era. And even then, it was two steps forward and one step back.
And we're going to end, this will be my last question. Can you just mentioned Emmett Till, and a lot of people are saying this is Trayvon is our modern day Emmett Till. And earlier, very early at the top of the show, you talked about his scream for help on the 911 tape. Could you just explain the similarities between Emmett Till's scream and what Mrs. Till did? I mean, Trayvon's scream and Emmett's picture in a Jet magazine.
Well, a number of things have been said about Emmett Till. Was 14 years old in Chicago visiting his relatives in Money, Mississippi over the summer in 1955, and that he was a kid from the city who was unused to the debilitating racial oppression of Mississippi, that he entered a store in this small little rural community that was run by, you know, pretty much poor working whites. And he was in the store with the white adult store owner. Something was said, something was disliked. It could be that he was not obsequious enough. He did not kowtow, break down, you know, kiss feet or whatever to this white woman. And that night, but we know there was no rape involved, there was no touching involved or anything like that. And that night, the woman's husband and half-brother descend on the relative's home in the middle of the night and take Emmett Till out. He is beaten, tortured, bludgeoned to death to the point where he was unrecognizable, and his body was tossed into the Tallahatchie River, which was, you know, he was found later. And his mother decided when his body was finally sent back up to Chicago that she would have an open casket. And there were a lot of people who didn't want her to have an open casket, but she said she's going to show the world what these people did to her son. There was a trial, and the trial, you know, the relatives who testified at trial as to what happened were threatened and had to leave town because, a lynch mob was coming for them. The two men who were charged were acquitted after a half an hour of jury deliberation by an all-white jury who had no intention whatsoever of finding them guilty. And so those two men were free, and they were allowed to get away with this crime. And so when we have the cry on the phone from the dispatcher in Trayvon Martin's case, the sense is, are we going to allow this cry to go unheard? Are we going to actually respond to it? Some people have said, just like the open casket, the cry on the phone is to let people know this is what's happening to a mother's son.
Right. And didn't they have to sue, Trayvon's lawyers have to sue to get that 911 tape released?
Well, they had to go through legal measures. And there are a number of other things. It's like the fact that you have the tape that was leaked, because ABC News, I believe, actually was the first to break the story of having the videotape from the police department. So here we have this videotape from the police department showing George Zimmerman coming out of the back of the police car, no blood on his clothes, no blood on his head, no blood on his face. And when he said his head was beaten against the ground by Trayvon, that, you know, his nose had been broken. But the other thing I want to come to this issue of nonviolence and this idea that if Trayvon did fight back, what was he supposed to do? This is not a police officer. This is
right.
One person, a grown man on the street in the rain, in the dark, coming up to someone saying, what are you doing in this neighborhood, or whatever kind of comment he made, and pushing him around. And it's like, and if you don't stop, and if you don't fall down on your knees, this reminds me more so of Amadou Diallo. In the Amadou Diallo case, in which he was shot at 41 times in his vestibule of his apartment building. And one of the things that really gets me is the fact that he was from Western Africa and had not grown up in this country. When people say, oh, when you saw white men coming to the vestibule of an all-black neighborhood, you're just supposed to immediately know that the police and put your hands up and fall to the ground. That, to me, is another vestige of slavery. To me, that's another vestige or remnant of the Jim Crow era, where you're supposed to immediately recognize anyone white as being in a power position than yourself and fall to the ground in complete obedience in order to live. That, to me, is something that we've missed out of this whole thing. Even if Trayvon did fight back, he had a right to fight back. That, to me, is stand your ground, not George Zimmerman pulling out a gun and killing him. Stand your ground is when someone comes up to you and says things to you and treats you in these ways in which you're supposed to, what, as a black man, just stand there, a black boy, stand there and have somebody push you around?
Right.
I don't think so. So we have to think about this as another era of civil rights. Are we supposed to always act in a nonviolent way when it comes to white people?
Well, it seems like you mentioned this is remnants of Jim Crow, and it seems like just our daily lifestyle is being criminalized. And you mentioned it, remnants of Jim Crow. And I was wondering, did you see the documentary Slavery by Another Name? Because earlier in the interview you talked about the Dred Scott case and the Constitution saying slavery has ended except by punishment, I think something to that nature. And that was a quote in the documentary. Could you, you know, talk about how they're criminalizing every activity, say, walking by while black, driving while black. You know, how can you live if everything you do is criminalized, where you have a TV host saying don't wear a hoodie because you're deemed a gangster and liable to get shot?
Well, yes, after slavery ended in 1865, then the Black Codes, C-O-D-E-S, the Black Codes for criminal laws that were enacted to criminalize everything black people did. And that was another way in which the South could find free labor. Because once a person committed a crime and they were convicted of that crime and they were in prison or in jail, their labor could be used for free by the prison system, by the jail system. And in using that labor for free, they were able to be the type of labor, slave labor, that the South was missing after slavery ended. And so that whole indentured servitude became the convict lease system, where convicts were leased out to private industry, leased out to businesses, leased out to municipalities, cities, towns, or whatever, individuals even, men and as well as women. You know, we're leased out in this way. And even today, you know, this idea that we have slave labor, but we don't call it slave labor as long as you pay someone something. So you have people who are incarcerated. If they earn 50 cents a day, then it's not slave labor because they're getting paid some money.
And besides that, what about the gerrymandering? When you have a prisoner from the inner city is imprisoned in a rural area, now they're counted as part of a census in another area, which now that area gets political power, just as they did with the three-fifths clause. But at least back then, we were only being counted three-fifths instead of a whole person. Whereas today, they get
whole. They're getting political power because those numbers are counted in to the population to decide based on the census. and population size, the representation in state, local, as well as federal government. They're also getting more resources in those little towns. Based on that population, they can go to the seat of government and say that we need more resources because we have all these people. But they're not representing the interests of those incarcerated people, and that's something that we really need to look at. We need to look at how we can make those government officials actually think about the needs of the incarcerated because they're in their district. So if you're in the district, then that representative is supposed to care about your actual needs. Where we find that most of the politicians in these small rural areas where the prisons are located have the worst types of conservative criminal records because they want to maintain the prisons and therefore maintain their political power and maintain the resources the prisons bring to their communities.
Wonderful. Well, we have to have you on again. Will you promise to come back on as the case evolves?
I look forward to it.
Great. I got a bunch of Facebook messages going on here. People are complimenting you left and right. You're very, very popular, and I want to thank you so much for coming at the last minute, I mean at a moment's notice, come on our show. And I want you, for the last time, to give your contact information and give us your parting words and thoughts.
Well, I'm founder director of the Law and Policy Group, and our report on the status of black women and girls is coming out in June. We try to have it come out around Juneteenth, so that's going to be coming out in June. It's the only ongoing report on the state of black females in America. It comes out every other year, and June 2012 will be the year for our report on the status of black women and girls. My book, Race, Law, and American Society, 1607 to Present, may be found on Amazon. If you want to give to my organization, we love contributions. We need it. If you want to help support our report on the status of black women and girls, please go to our website, and that's Law and Policy Group. That's the name of our organization, the Law and Policy Group. And there's a PayPal set up for you to give. We really need support for our report on the status of black women and girls. And, of course, my book coming out sometime this year will be Black Women, Salem Witch Trials, The Civil Rights Activist, A Legal History. So I look forward to having you come to my book signings when that takes place and meeting you in person, you know, people who are on the show. I look forward to that.
Wonderful. And again, have a great night. We will be talking very soon. And have a good night and keep doing what you're doing.
Well, and remember, this arrest of George Zimmerman is just the beginning. Let's not sit down on the cause.
Right. Okay. Thanks again, Professor. We'll talk soon.
Okay. Good night.
All right. Bye-bye.